Matthew chapter 28. Now, this is the Great Commission passage. I'm sure you all know it. And it's funny, I went to a missions conference. You know, I live in Tulsa. That's the capital of the religious capital of the world. So they have all kinds of things going on, but they had a missions conference, and so I went to it, and it was interesting to see all these different missionaries and mission organizations with their displays, and everybody used Matthew 28:19. So, you know, I considered taking it off my letterhead when I came back to the office. But I'm kidding, of course. It's an often quoted passage, but it's extremely important. And let me just take you through it briefly. And I'd like to perhaps help you to look at it in a slightly different perspective than you've seen it before. I'll read it first in English, and I'm going to give the corrected translation. It says, "Go therefore and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I commanded you, and lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age." Now, in this passage, you have one command, not three or four, just one. In the Greek, you have one imperative, and then you have three participles. And quickly, all that means is you have one command, and the three participles describe how to fulfill that one command. So let me give you the corrected translation. Make disciples. That's the command. And this is how you do it. You do it by going. You do it by evangelizing. I'm kind of taking liberties here with the word baptizing, but that's what's being implied here, is the baptizing of the process of evangelism. So make disciples, one, by going, two, by evangelizing, and three, by teaching. This is the Great Commission. As you go, and as you evangelize, and as you teach, you are making disciples. And that's really our calling. That's what we as Christians are supposed to do. We're supposed to make disciples. Now, I bring this out in this way because of all the mission trips I've been on and the different countries I've been to, I've seen a lot of missionaries and I've seen a lot of mission activity. And it's wonderful that so many people are doing so much. And having been to Russia, having lived there for 2 years and traveled back and forth, I think, 7 or 8 times, I saw a lot of Americans, a lot of Christians going to Russia. But what most of them did was evangelize, and that was it. They didn't do anything else. And really, they didn't fulfill the Great Commission. They only started the job, but they didn't finish it. Now, it's great that they wanted to see people get saved. That's an attitude we should all have. But really, the responsibility we have as Christians is to make disciples, and that includes the whole process. And though not all of us can go overseas or to some country or to an Indian reservation or to the poor people of West Virginia or to the North Tulsa or wherever, not all of us can necessarily do that. We can support through prayer and encouragement and financially and materials someone who does do that, and that's how we all as a team fulfill this commission. When I went to Russia and I talked to a few missionaries who lived in the Soviet Union, I asked them how things were going and what their needs were. What are your frustrations? And every one of them, which is three or four people I talked to, but every one of them said the same thing. And so our biggest frustration is that all these Christians come over here and they evangelize and they pass out tracts and they work on the streets and then they go home. And he said, and they leave all these brand new Christians with no place to go, and we can't handle it all. Or we don't have any way to get a hold of these people to bring them into our Bible studies. And it's really frustrating. And I was so moved, for lack of a better word, the first time I went over there that I decided to resign from Glen Haven. I figured my job was done anyway. And so I literally moved over there to try to do some discipleship. Let's take doctrine. Let's take the Word of God, Bible teaching that we know and appreciate. Let's take it to the Soviet Union. Let's take it to Africa. Let's take it to people who don't have it. You know, I've often thought, and this, as I reflected back on my own life, and I think you could probably do the same, but I remember how I was before I got this type of Bible teaching. I remember how I'd go to church Sunday after Sunday and week after week, and I would learn a little bit here and a little bit there and a little bit there, and I remember my first 3 months in a Bible church. And I remember at the time I was in Virginia Beach, Virginia, thinking, you know, I've learned more here in 3 months than I've learned my entire life going to church. And I think you could probably relate to that. And what a difference it's made in my life and in your lives. We think so much differently. Life is so much better. We're more relaxed. We can handle things now that before were so difficult for us. We understand things now we never understood before. We see some guy on television and he says, well, you need to do this and this and this. And now we can sit there and say, no, we don't. You're wrong. And we say that because now, as Ephesians 4 says, we have grown to the point where we're no longer being tossed to and fro with every wind of doctrine. We have God, obviously, to thank for that, but it's the type of teaching that has really caused us to grow. And my thinking was, let's give that to other people. You know, Africa, I stood in Africa 1 year, and I'm sitting there, and I meet other religious people and missionaries coming in, and I'm thinking, you know, what a shame. I said, here we, our predecessors, people in this country, and Portuguese and Spanish and the Dutch, here they come into this continent and they steal some of these people or barter and buy these people, and they take them and they make slaves of them in South America and Central America and North America. They make slaves of them. And isn't it sad, isn't it good now that people aren't coming into Africa and taking the Africans and making slaves anymore? But you know, they're still making slaves of them, because now we have religious people going in and telling them they have to wear this and they have to do this and they can't do this. And I look, and it's just a sad thing. And the truth, you said, know the truth, and the truth shall make you free, shall set you free. And so my motivation was to get good Bible teaching to people so they have the freedom that we've enjoyed. That's what got me going. And to make disciples is more than just giving the gospel. It's taking doctrine. It's taking Bible teaching. It's training people to train other people. That's really our calling, our commission. If you will, flip over to Acts chapter 14. I want to give you an example of what I believe the goal of every missionary should be. Every mission organization, every missionary should pursue this objective. And the example we have here of the apostles, Paul, I think it's Paul and Barnabas in this context. In Acts chapter 14, verses 21 through 24. Verse 21, and after they, referring to the apostles, had preached the gospel to that city. This was a Derby, I guess it was, up above. But after they had preached the gospel to that city and made many disciples, they returned to Lystra and to Iconium and to Antioch. And here's what they did when they got to these cities where they were evangelizing and making disciples. Here was their procedure. Verse 22. First, they strengthened the souls of the disciples, the students. The way they did it is they did it by encouraging them to continue in the faith, and they strengthened their souls by preaching or teaching them by saying, through many tribulations we must enter the kingdom of God. In other words, you know, be steadfast, be strong, don't give up, don't quit, but you're going to face some problems. And then, after they got done teaching and encouraging, verse 23, this is what they did. They appointed elders for them in every church, and then they prayed with fasting. Then they commended them to the Lord in whom they had believed, and then they passed through Pisidia and came into Pamphylia. In 20th century English, this is what happened. They went in, they evangelized, and then they taught and trained these people. And then when they got them somewhat going and growing, they said, okay, you and you and you and you and you are going to be leaders in these churches. All right? Now, we prayed about it. We're going to pray with you. So we pray, and we say, okay, Godspeed, we're out of here. It's all yours. And they left. And we see this from Paul's missionary journeys. We see this a lot, where Paul would go into an area and he'd work in an area for 2 months, 3 months, a year, year and a half sometimes, and then he was gone. But he always left somebody behind, either somebody he had trained in that city or someone he had been training who had traveled with him, and he left them behind and he went on down the road. The goal of every missionary is to make disciples wherever they go. And when they make disciples, the objective is to work themselves out of a job as soon as they possibly can. That's what I believe Scripture teaches is our responsibility for missions. And there are a lot of good missionary organizations. A lot of them. Campus Crusade, YWAM, and different groups. And a lot of them are doing a good job. But I felt that we needed to do something ourselves. We needed to get our people out there, get our people involved in missions. And so I started Village Missions International. And what I wanted to do, I had so many things going through my mind, and I could talk for hours, I won't do that, but I had so many things just motivating me. But one of the things I had discovered in talking to different organizations and reading their literature is that it seemed like every organization had some kind of requirement for their people. Let's say, for example, one of you applied at Wesleyan World Missions. That's one of the organizations I researched. You want to apply at Wesleyan World Missions, okay? And you said you feel called or led to be a missionary in China. And Wesleyan would say, okay, well, you need to raise support, and you're going to need $51,000 a year. Based on our 1995 budget, you need $51,000. You need 25% of it up front. All right? And that's what you need to do. Another missionary organization might say, well, what's your education? Have you been to seminary? Have you been to a Bible school or Bible college? No, you've only sat in a pew for a number of years. You're not qualified, I'm sorry. Or you feel led to go to Nigeria? That's fine, you need $51,000, but you only have $20,000. I'm sorry, you can't go. Now, I have a problem with all this. And so I started an organization where anybody can go who wants to go as long as they feel called to go, and they don't have to have any kind of money. In other words, they have just a minimum. I said, you have to have enough to get yourself there and back. You know, I don't want you to get there and not be able to get home. So you have to have round trip tickets. And for liability purposes and for common sense purposes, you need to have medical insurance. I have a group plan. You need so much a month. I think right now it's $80 a month for a single person for medical insurance. And you got to have enough money to either rent an apartment over there or to do something, but you got to be able to live at least for the first 3 months. So you can get over there and get started, and that's what you got to do. So that's all. If you feel motivated, if you believe the Lord's leading you to the mission field, it might only be for a year. I don't even ask you to commit for a lifetime. Let's go for one school year. You feel led to do it? Fine. You write letters. I'll help you write letters. You send them to your family and friends. And if God gives you the wherewithal, the money to be able to go, then you go. The money comes through VMI. We're the nonprofit organization, so it's tax deductible, and you're accountable, and everything's legit, and you go. And so that's what I did. And it's worked. It's been very successful. But that wasn't the only reason I started a mission organization. Again, there's so many of what makes us different and why reinvent the wheel. I'm not. I'm doing it really differently. Another reason is I wanted to get you on the mission field. I wanted you to have a mission trip. I know you have a job, and I know you have family, and I know you have responsibilities, and I know the last thing in the world you want to do is to move to Timbuktu. Herman and I were talking yesterday, and Herman said, I remember when I was young, I prayed, I'll do anything, I'll give to missions, but please, God, don't send me on the mission field. And there's even a contemporary Christian song that says, please don't send me to Africa. And so not all of you want to do that, but what I've done is I've taken over 100 people to different countries and given them the opportunity to serve as a missionary for 2 weeks or so. I sent 100 people, actually 120 people to Russia, but that number is a little bit misleading because some of those people went 3 or 4 times or 5 times. But 120 people have gone to the Soviet Union, and I sent 10 people to Africa. And I've had 3 people in South America and 1 person to the Philippines. So you get a chance to go and be a missionary for a couple weeks. You evangelize, you teach. And what I tried to do is always send you into a place where I have missionaries working. Remember what I said in the beginning about the discipleship process? So we don't just go in and pass out tracts and come back and boast about how many people we gave tracts to. We go and we lead people to the Lord and we witness and we give our testimony or whatever. And then when you leave, then I have missionaries left behind to continue on the work. So that's what we've done. And that's one of our objectives and goals. And lastly, going along with Acts chapter 14, our objective is to work ourselves out of a job or to get the indigenous people. I remember one of my newsletters, if I'm not real careful, I end up misspelling or putting wrong words. In one of my newsletters, I was talking about the indigenous people, and I spelled it in such a way that I was talking about the indigenous people of Africa. But we need to get the indigenous people. We need to get these people saved, evangelized, and then we train them, indoctrinate them, and teach them how to teach, and teach them how to study, and help them work. And so what we've done is we've supported indigenous workers with salary so that they can devote themselves to ministry. These are men and women that we've recruited, and then and I set up a call them field administrators or regional administrators. I have somebody who's the boss, and he's responsible for all that, and that has been unbelievably successful. In fact, I got into this sort of thing primarily or originally because of the success that we had in Africa, in Nigeria. I went to Nigeria for the first time in 1990, and I went there with two other men. And I went along with one of the men was my pastor at the time, and I went with him just to be his executive officer, just to help him and support him and so he could do his thing. I had no desire to go to Africa. But we had a man there who had been listening to tapes, this guy's tapes, and was so fired up and so turned on that we decided, well, we would just keep sending him tapes and get him written material and Bibles and do what we could to help him with this ministry or this vision that he had. And so we did that. And the next year I took two people with me and we went and taught several Bible classes. And by that time he had three or four workers. And then the next year we went and by that time he had 10 workers or 8 or 10 workers. And then I couldn't get into the country for 2 years. And then I went last year and he had like 14 or 15 workers. And this year I took four people with me to Nigeria, West Africa, and now he's got 14 full-time workers. And I've been supporting this guy all this time, financially as well. And what we've done is for the past 3 years, I've been sending $500 a month to this guy. And I send him a budget sheet. I'm real tight sometimes. And I send him this budget sheet, and I said, okay, this is your salary, and this is Linus' salary, and this is Pius' salary, and this is Joseph's salary, and this is so-and-so and so-and-so and Grace and Lucy's, and I have it all broken down, and they all have to sign this sheet of paper. But what, in effect, what we've been able to do is we have provided full or partial salaries for 14 people, and as a result, they've been able to feed their families, so we have provided for somewhere between 35 and 40 people, their total living. And this has freed them up. These are all villagers, farmers by trade. And this has freed them up to focus on ministry, studying the Word, teaching the Word, and evangelizing. It's been phenomenal for $500 a month. That's what we've done. Now, I don't want this to overshadow the importance of sending our missionaries because they're the ones who have been sitting in these pews and these churches for years and have the doctrine, or these are the ones who have been to seminary or have been to Bible college or whatever. These are the trainers. But once we get them trained, when I spend $800 to $1,000 a month roughly on a single missionary, about $800 on a single missionary every month and $1,000 to $1,200 on a married couple, that's for one person or one couple. Well, I feed 40 people. Half of what it takes for one single person. So you see, if you look at it from a business perspective, you really get a lot of souls for your dollar. So it's really been good. Plus, I believe that we're going right along with what the apostles gave us as an example. And then when I take you over there for 2 weeks, it's unbelievable how encouraged the local people are that you would come over. Especially to Africa. Russia too, but Africa, they just can't believe it. First of all, that a white person would go to so much trouble for a black over there because they had been under British rule at one time, and so, you know, there was definitely a social distinction. But that you would pay money and go all the way over and endure such hard, difficult conditions, it's just amazing. And I go into a village because I'm white, first, and secondly because I'm American. I go into a village and I get into the E.F. Hutton syndrome. Do you remember that commercial years ago? You know, I get in there and when the white American speaks, everyone listens. I have the chiefs and I have the witch doctors and I have the whole village, and you can hear a pin drop. And what an opportunity for evangelism. My African workers cannot get into these villages. But once I go, or once you go, that's instant credibility, and now that village is open to my African workers from now until Christ returns. It's maybe not right that it's that way, but that's just the way it is. And even in the Soviet Union, I go in to the public schools and do it almost anything I want, and they just kind of tolerate it because I'm an American and I don't know any better. And what can they do to me? So, you know, the opportunities that we have as foreigners, and I've often thought about this. The opportunities are fabulous, but I thought about this too. If a Russian person came to Dallas to visit, and one of you is a school teacher, and you invited him or her to come to your class to speak to your students, this is kind of novelty. Here you have this Russian. He's here and he's talking to his students. What an opportunity. Well, the Russian gets in and he talks about life in the Soviet Union. He talks, gives examples of the Russian language and some of the words and tries to get the kids to speak a few Russian words, and it's big fun. And then he explains why he's here. He's here because he's a Christian and he wants to get some Bible materials and get some Bible studies that he can't get over there, because believing in Jesus Christ is something that his people were never really given the privilege of doing for almost two generations. And now we have a little bit of freedom, not as much as people think we have, but now we can have faith in Jesus Christ. And now, because of my faith in Jesus Christ, I know I'm going to heaven. And now my family has hope that they never had before. And we even can read the Bible now without being afraid of losing our jobs or going to prison. It's so wonderful. Well, here, this Russian man just evangelized your students. And nobody cares. You're not in trouble, and he's not in trouble because he's Russian. He doesn't know any better. And that's some of the opportunities we have, right or wrong, or just taking advantage of human nature and human frailties, that we've been able to do a tremendous amount in both Africa and the Soviet Union. In Africa, we have just a few numbers, if I can get you straight. We have, this year, our team planted, well, we evangelized seven villages, or eight or nine villages, but seven of the villages were going to turn into churches. So technically, we planted seven new churches in Ghana this year in West Africa. And in Nigeria, we planted one new church, and then we evangelized several villages and worked a lot of different villages. I estimated that five of us combined taught 75 Bible classes in just over 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks. It was just unbelievable. From village to village to village to village to village. In the last 6 years, from 1990, the first time I went there, we have built, well, we in Nigeria we now have, I always lose track of this, 12 churches, I think, 12 churches and 6 Bible study groups in Nigeria. And of those 12 churches, we built either 5 or 6 church buildings. I built church buildings. The cheapest I ever built a church building was for nothing. I exchanged money at the right time just before it went up. I don't know what happened, but I was there at the right time. And the exchange rate was this, and all of a sudden it dropped. And so I exchanged $1,000, and then all of a sudden it jumped. And then we bought building materials. And the money I saved was enough to build a church building. It was $500 worth of materials at that time. But we built buildings. You'll see some pictures of them. We built buildings for as little as $500 and as much as $1,500 for a church building, which is fabulous. That's with a tin roof instead of the grass roof, so it lasts longer that way. We've evangelized, well, all those villages. You know, I don't know how many people we've led to the Lord, but it's in the thousands, I suppose, low thousands. We have 14 full-time workers. These people are evangelizing and teaching. They're either pastors, teachers, or evangelists working full-time for us. we baptize. It's real important for the Africans to be water baptized because it allows them an opportunity. And we know water baptism is a public declaration of our faith. It represents something we have a tendency to take it a little more lightly. Over there, it's extremely important for them to be baptized because they are showing a separation from their old ways, which was witchcraft or something related to the spiritism, to this new Christian faith. And it's a big deal. In fact, I baptized a couple hundred people, I suppose. You get to the point where your arm gets tired, you just keep going. But I had this old woman. I was walking through the bush, through the jungle, one afternoon toward the end of the day, and Matthias is my main worker over there, and he introduced me to this elderly woman. He said, "This is one of our sisters, one of our members." And I greeted her. And he said, "She really wanted to be baptized." And I said, "Well, that's great. Well, I'll just have her come Sunday when we baptize everybody." And he said, "Oh, no, she can't because she's too feeble. She can't make it to the creek where we do this." And I said, "Well, is there some way we can take her?" He said, "Well, no, we don't have transportation because she's out in the jungle and it's a long walk just to get to any kind of road." And I said, "Well, is there any place else we can baptize her?" He said, "Well, there's a creek near here. We could baptize her." I said, "Let's do it." He said, "When?" I said, "Let's do it right now." Well, he said, "Well, you'll get all wet." I said, "Well, that's okay. It's all right. If it's important to her, let's just go do it." So we got there, got to this creek, and I asked her, I said, "Do you want us to carry you?" She said, "No, she can make it." So Matthias and I went on, and sure enough, the lady came. We helped her down the bank, the creek bank, into the creek, and the water was about that deep. So I sat her down in the water, and then I put her under the water. It was just enough to get her under water and brought her up again, and she had tears coming down her face because it meant so much to her. You see, we can't really relate to that, but it was just so important. And when they become members of our churches in Africa, in Nigeria, we have to promise to bury them, because once they become a Christian, they're no longer part of the spiritism and all this, the secret societies anymore. And in many cases, they're ostracized or even evicted from their homes, especially if they're children or adult teenagers. And so the biggest fear was that that when they died, and they usually die in their 50s or before, that when they died, that nobody would bury them and their bodies would just be out in the jungle. So we have to commit to burying them and pay for that, which is just the price of concrete. But so, you know, it's just kind of different, some of the things we've seen over there. But it's so exciting to be able to work with people like this or to minister to people like this that it means so much. And those are a few of the things we've been able to do with very little effort. I mean, I did a lot of this when I was at Glen Haven, and I couldn't devote very much time or effort to it because my primary responsibility was at the ranch. So I put out a letter every 3 months, sometimes every 6 months. And there were enough people around the country who'd give a little bit of money, and we just had enough, and I'd send it all to Nigeria. And then if I could, I'd get away every January and go to Africa, take a couple people with me, and we'd have this mission trip. It's just phenomenal. In Russia, I went over there first in 1992, in May of 92, went back again, took a team with me. I went alone in 92, in May. And then in November, I took a team of 8 people with me, and we hit the schools, and we had the entire city open up to us. And then in March of 93, I moved there and started bringing in missionaries, and by September I had 6 full-time missionaries. We opened the Bible Institute, had 120 students enroll in this Bible Institute on registration day. We taught these people just like Bible class in church, only 4 hours a night, Monday night through Thursday night. And they enrolled in 2 courses, 2 2-hour courses. So they could either do a 1 class Monday and the next one Tuesday, or Monday and Wednesday, or Tuesday and Thursday, or Tuesday and Wednesday, whatever they wanted to do. But they enrolled, and we gave them 4 hours a week instruction, and then at the end of the semester, we gave them a little certificate saying they completed the course. Just Bible class is all it was. We just organized it, called it systematic theology, or we called it Bible survey, and that's what we did. You know, some of these people were so excited, and we can't relate to this. They were so excited, and I had them sign up, and they signed up for what they wanted. They were at 6 o'clock Monday night. The first Monday, I must have had almost the entire 120 people there. The classroom only seated 90. I mean, they're packed in like sardines, and they're standing. And I'm thinking, my gosh, where these people come from? Monday at 6 o'clock. So we teach, and of course, Herman, you can really appreciate this. And when you have people who want to learn, and especially a full house, and these people, some of them were sitting on, it's like they were on the edge of their chairs, and their mouths were hanging open. It's like, I never heard anything like this before. And so you teach for an hour, and you take a 5 or 10 minute break, and you hit it again for about another 45 or 50 minutes, and then I go home, and the next American, one of my missionaries, would stand up and teach, do the same thing. And that was Monday night, and boy, we're excited. We said, man, this is great. I don't know if we're going to have anybody in class tomorrow or Thursday, Wednesday or Thursday, since they're all here tonight. Tuesday night, they were all back again. And so I'm teaching the same class at 6 o'clock Tuesday that I taught at 8 o'clock Monday. So I tell the people, I said, you must be confused. I'm sorry, but tonight I'm getting ready to teach the same thing I taught last night. You know, because we do this, you know, twice a week. So if you want to go home, it's fine. And I don't know, I can't remember, but an older person raised a hand and said, well, we know that, but we want to hear it again. So we had some of those people 16 hours a week, 4 hours a night, and they just couldn't get enough. And even though it was repetitive, it was just, give me more, give me more, give me more. So, you know, we had our Bible Institute for 2 full years, and then this last year, we actually turned it into more of a discipleship class because of problems with the government. Nobody would let us use their facilities anymore, and so we had to rent an apartment and squeeze in 25 or 30, and we really started fine-tuning those 25 or 30 people in for ministry. So that's what we've done. We've worked the schools. We've evangelized the schools. We had, in the beginning, we had freedom to do anything we wanted in any school. But as soon as we started doing it, they started tightening up and tightening up and tightening up, and we eventually lost almost all that. We had orphanages. We had children's hospitals. Here in the United States, we had our youth camps, our Arkansas camp. Some of you are familiar with that, and that was such a success, and it ended up starting in 7 other states or something. So I started a youth camp over there. And boy, I'd have mothers coming. Can my child go? And I said, well, you know, we're full already. Oh, please, they don't have to eat. Can they just go? And so what we were supposed to have, 250 kids, we ended up with 3 1/4 or 330 kids. And we ended up with, you know, 300 students per camp. And we've had 4 of those, and it's just been phenomenal. So the ministry opportunities and the response to the gospel and the response to teaching is just, it's just unbelievable. Unreal. There's no way I can, I can't communicate it well enough, but it's just, it was quite an experience. That's what we've been able to do. And we've done that because many of you have given to us, have prayed for us, you supported Phil McMillan, you supported, he's with me this year. And you've done some of this, as well as other churches. And it's just been terrific. What I want to do is I want to, I'll show you some slides on Africa. What are we doing on time tonight, Herman? How are we doing? What time do you want to knock it off? Okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to show some Africa slides. And then I'm going to just give you a few needs and prayer requests. And then I'm going to show you some Russian slides. But the Russian slides, I'm not going to talk. I'm just going to, I have an audio tape. I'm going to let it play and flip the slides because the words of the song really say more than I could say anyway. But on Africa, I'm going to show you just a few pictures so you get an idea of what some of the people look like. And I kind of go through these relatively fast. And, but while we do this, you know, I'm up here now, so I'm the boss. Herman's not, so I'm joking. But if you have any questions or anything, raise your hand, you know, holler out. Let's just make this as informal as possible, okay? If you want to see the slide again, could you back that one up or whatever, and we'll do that. And I think what I'll do is I'll sit down. Let me see if I can do this. This is a common scene. They carry everything on their heads, and the children, even at a very young age, they work and help around the family, and everybody works. And it's some of the hardest working people I've ever met, especially the women. They work especially hard. This is a typical scene in a village. This is where we stay when we go to Africa, and to Nigeria in particular. We stay right in the villages. The women do all the cooking and food preparation and washing clothes, and they do it all out back behind one of the huts or houses. And this is meal preparation. And this is some of the scenery of, I can't remember if this is Ghana or Nigeria. I think this is Ghana. We work in southeastern Nigeria, and we work in south central Ghana. And in both places, we work in the mountains. So the scenery is similar. This is Nigeria. This is a typical view. When we walking through the jungle, we follow these little footpaths, and then we step out, and all of a sudden we're in a village, and this is what one of the villages look like. And throughout the mountain areas, at the base of the mountains, and even up on top of the mountains, you'll find villages like this. And everyone in the village is related, so it's kind of a family type thing, you know, over several generations. So they're all cousins and distant cousins. This is a typical. The ones on the right are the traditional village huts with a thatched roof. On the left, kind of off the screen a little bit, but it's more of a square, rectangular building, mud brick with the tin roof. They're trying to make more of those. The only problem is they have to buy the tin, where the other ones, they don't have to buy anything except a little bit of lumber. Once we get into a village, we get the people to gather around. I usually will meet with the chief, get permission to speak to the people. And then that we'll gather the people somehow. We take our workers with us, so they bring the children and the adults in, who's ever not at their farm. We get them all together, and we prepare to teach a Bible class. Yes, sir. Well, we speak English, but our interpreters will interpret into the dialect. And in Nigeria, they have 500 dialects in the one country. So sometimes we have to use two and even three interpreters. So I'll speak English, and my interpreter will speak Bete, I think is the name of the language primarily we work with, and then somebody else will go into something else. But all of our English is spoken, read, and understood by the Nigerian people or African people very well, because the British were there for so many years, and English is their official language. But in the villages, they're fairly uneducated, so they just normally just speak the dialect. This is the team we took this year, and we're in a traditional Nigerian dress, which our workers bought or made for us. I felt like I was wearing my pajamas. And this boy, young man here on the right, his name is Keith Medley. He's from Columbus, Ohio. He's 17 years old. He's a high school senior. Went with us in 1992. This young man is Kenny Nichols. He went with us in 1990. He taught children. We'd find kids in the compound or in a small village, and we'd just sit under a tree and tell the kids Bible stories, and with the adults, we would just preach or teach a very basic, easy-to-understand Bible lesson. With our workers, we had seminary-type classes. So we'd either sit out under a tree, or we'd go inside one of the houses, and we would teach theology for 3 or 4 hours every day. We would evangelize and teach in the villages before daylight every morning for morning devotions. We'd come back, we'd bathe and eat, relax a little bit, then we'd have seminary classes until about 1 or 2 in the afternoon. We'd rest an hour or 2 hours, then we'd go back into the villages and work until sundown, and then we'd come back. That was our normal routine. We do a lot of one-on-one discipleship, answer questions, show them scripture. This is Matthias on the right. This was taken in 1990. He was a little bit younger back then. But this is Matthias on the right. This is Gene Cunningham here in the middle. He was my pastor at the time. And Africa was really his dream, and I went just to help him in the beginning. And here he's discipling, evangelizing. This was in Ghana, and this young man was the house boy, and he would be the guard, and he would sit up all night outside our compound to make sure nobody came in and bothered us. And he was a Muslim. So at 5 in the morning, the Muslims, you'd hear them chant and do their thing. Well, I went out there shortly after 5, and he was sitting there, and I had a chance to witness to him and led him to the Lord. This one of the ladies that went with us this year, teaching Bible class to children in the village where we stayed. These kids would come from all over. They knew we were there, so they'd come from all over just to get Bible classes. So our ladies and some of the men would teach the children 4, 5, 6 times a day just in our village. This is Matthias this year and his family. It's his wife and 5 children, 4 daughters and a son. These are some of his workers. There's 14 workers, 2 women and 12 men. Matthias in the middle with some of his men. These guys are all, I think every one of them are pastors. I think possibly one of them is a student pastor, but I think the rest of them are pastors of our churches. This is Donna. James Owusu is the short, older man in the middle. He's my main worker, supervisor in Ghana, and these are some of his workers. Now, we have not supported them financially other than when I go over there, I give them some cash to help with expenses, but we've not been in a position to support them monthly like we have in Nigeria. When we go into the villages, we gather up the kids or the adults, or we go to them if they're out working or whatever. And here's 2 of our ladies this year. The kids were out singing and dancing, so they went out and wanted to dance with them. And ended up having a Bible class after that. This was back in 1990 again. That's Matthias in the upper right-hand corner. And Gene Cunningham telling a Bible story to the children. This is this year, and I'm teaching I think a couple of the churches came together for a Sunday morning service. And we just met outside. We put up chairs or benches, or they would stand. And we had church service out there. When they come to church, they sometimes they'll walk for a long time. We had an older couple a couple years ago walk for, I guess, 8 to 10 miles just to get to a church service like this, and then they stay there all day. And so these people, most of them stayed there all day, had lunch there, and then just sat around and fellowship. This one of our Americans this year, he's from Columbus, Ohio, too, in fact. He's gone to wrestle with me several times. We taught our workers seminary classes, and the ladies asked if they would have special classes. They like to come to our seminary classes, which is fine, but they also wanted to know if we could bring women this year on our team and provide them with classes pertinent to women. So I took 2 female missionaries with me this year, and they taught ladies classes. One of them taught women in the Bible, and the other one taught some basic theology. And did a good job, and women seem to enjoy it. One of them was Pat Hill, Dan Hill's wife. She's always wanted to go to Africa, and I normally didn't take women because it's so difficult and it's a little dangerous, but I talked to Matthias, and he said that he felt that it wouldn't be a problem and it'd really be helpful to have women go and work with their women, and it was very successful, so I'm glad it worked out. This is one of our guys. He's a deacon at Dan Hill's church. It's the first time he's ever done anything like this, so he was nervous and excited. This is a group I spoke to a few years ago. And when they know you're there, a lot of times they just come in hordes. I mean, you get large crowds. This is one of our buildings being built. And all of our workers and the villagers build the buildings. They give us the land. We pay for the materials, and they have to do all the labor. And so that's one of our buildings. And that's one of our buildings finished. That's what they look like. And this is, I think, our first church building. And this is what it looks like inside. No electricity or anything, so we use flashlights or oil lamps. If it's dark. And this is one of our churches and one of our church buildings. All of our churches are called Grace Bible Church. Not much of imagination, I'm afraid, on my part, but I wanted to have some uniformity, so we just call them Grace Bible Church and then use the village name with it. When we don't have a church building, this is how our churches meet. So we've got about 10 churches who meet this way, which is not a problem during the dry season, but during the rainy season, it's a serious problem because it's always raining or it's always muddy. And so it's been a problem. So buildings is very important. Besides Bible teaching and evangelizing, we also do a little bit of humanitarian aid. Don't do a lot, but we do a little. This boy on the bicycle, that's actually a wheelchair, and he's crippled. His legs don't work. He had polio. And when I first started going over, he used to come to our classes, and he would scoot on his rear end, and he'd use shower shoes on his hands. And that's how he went places, and he would sometimes go miles. And we baptized, one of our baptisms, he couldn't get down the riverbank into the river to be baptized. And we almost missed him because we didn't see him up on the bank. So we carried him down in the water, baptized him, carried him back out again. And we bought this, whatever you call it, wheelchair or bicycle. We pedaled by hand for him. And he's had that, I guess, three or four years now. In addition to that type of humanitarian aid, we also take care of orphans. This is Matthias with his family, and he's got 6 orphans. Got the two girls on the far left, and then the girl in the red is the sister of Matthias's wife, so she's not an orphan. The next girl is an orphan. The one in the very back, kind of tall girl, older girl, is an orphan, and then the two on the right. And most of these girls, if not all of them, were evicted from their families, from their houses or from their villages when they became Christians. So Matthias just took them in, and we built this house Matthias lives in now, so it has 4 or 5 rooms, and they sleep on the floor, and Matthias feeds them all. So this is one of our ministries. It's actually been going on now for about 4 or 5 years. And this is, again, some of the children, some of our children, and sharing meals. This is what our food looks like. It's it's real bland. It's not very tasty. Those are peanuts on the left. They grow over there, and they roast them for us unsalted. In the middle, it's greens, like turnip greens, chopped up real fine, or palm leaves. And on the right, that's called fufu, or yam, pounded yam. And it has the texture of cookie dough. It looks like mashed potatoes, but it has no flavor at all. And you can see my hand there. You pinch some, roll it in a ball, and then you dip it, and you eat it with your hands, and you use your thumb to pinch a little greens or sauce or something to it. And we normally don't have meat. Sometimes we have fish in a sauce, and it's real strong fishy smell. We have goat meat. We have rat we eat. And otherwise, we just eat this. Now, the rat, or field rat, and I know it sounds awful, and they don't look very appetizing, but they don't taste too bad. And, you know, they're not scavenging around in your garbage cans first. You know, they eat grass and whatever. They're part of the rabbit family, but they are rats. And when we eat, it's always entertainment for the children to see the white people eat. So we get these kids, and they come in, and we're sitting on the other side of that window eating, and these kids are standing there watching us. And, you know, it's so hot, we usually try to take naps in the afternoon, and so many times I'll wake up from a nap, and as soon as I open my eyes, there's 5 or 6 little black faces looking in the window, watching me sleep. And it's quite a treat. And they come up, and they're usually afraid of you at first, but then once they realize you're not going to hurt them, then they come up, sometimes they'll grab your hand and hold your hand, and then they rub your skin sometimes to see if maybe it's dark underneath. It's just, it's really funny to see that. But these kids, they keep coming and keep coming. They want more Bible classes. This is Matthias' son, and he's real special, but he named him Jody. So I have his picture everywhere in my office. Yeah, he's quite a character. These are some of the kids. This is a nighttime scene. And this this little girl's probably on the left, in the middle there with the pink. She's probably 8 years old, maybe a little younger, somewhere in that age. And she, the children, they take care of their siblings. They'll carry them around if they're newborn babies, or they'll just become like mothers to them. And this is I took this picture after one of the children's classes, and they gave an invitation. So the kids were praying, and I happened to catch this picture. So that's, I think that's the last one. That's Africa. And I'll go ahead and show you these Russian pictures here in just a minute. But do you have any questions about Africa before I do? Anything at all? One of the things, as I mentioned before, we'd like to start supporting James Owusu and his workers in Nigeria. So if you'll put that on your prayer list or consideration. We're sending $500 a month to Matthias. I just upped that. He asked for $60 a month more. So we upped that to $560 this year, and we'd like to send $300 a month to Ghana. Ghana's just a little bit more expensive, but not too bad. And so we hope to do that. And I have that. I have some newsletters and different things on the back table. Please help yourself. I probably brought too many things. I don't want to burn you out on reading, but you get a bunch of stuff and you put them in your magazine rack and read them over a period of time. But I have some Africa newsletters and then letters updating you on Russia and what's going on over there and some different things. I'll tell you that when we get out there. But also, if you want to be on the mailing list, my policy is the same as it was at Glenhaven. We don't ask for money. And we won't send beg letters or anything. If you want to be on a mailing list, I'll send you my newsletter once a month or every other month to keep you updated on what's going on. I would like to invite you to go on a mission trip with us. You can choose the countries we're going to right now. And if you have contacts in another country, that's fine. I'll take you there. But we have a summer camp. We're probably already full for that one in July. And we're taking 12 Americans there. But I'm trying to put together a team to take to southern Russia, two new places that I just laid the groundwork for new ministries. One of them's north of Chechnya, the other one's south of Chechnya. So we have to go around because of the war, but we have two, it's safe, but we have two ministry opportunities. No mission activity, that's where I always try to go. It's the James T. Kirk philosophy. I want to go where no man has gone before. But we try to go to places where there's not other mission activity, either villages or small cities. And so we have two places in southern Russia. And I'm trying to open up a seminary in Kiev in the Ukraine. So I've been working on that too. So you might keep that in prayer because I need theologians for that and I don't have any. So I don't know if that's going to work, but we'll see. But if you'd like to go on a trip, I have teams going in November. I have them going in March. We got a team leaving in 2 weeks. And, you know, you let me know 6 months or something before so you have time to raise some money. I'll help you with that, tell you how to do that. I can assure you, you can handle it. Africa would be the only possible exception, but any of you can handle Russia. If you've never led anybody to the Lord, I'll teach you how to do it. If you've never talked in front of people, it's a piece of cake. You don't have to be Herman or me or a theologian to do that. You just be yourself. And all I can tell you is once you go on a mission trip, you'll never be the same again. It'll have an effect on you that it's hard to explain. Well, the rats will have an effect too. So anyway, but I would like to invite you to go on a trip, and if you get on the mailing list, just put an asterisk by your name and I'll remember that you're interested in possibly going on a trip, and so we'll send you a letter when we have a team we're putting together and just see what you do. Pray about this, think about it, but please don't not go because you don't think you can do it. Now, Africa is a little different. I'd want you to be able to go camping basically for 2 weeks and use the woods for a toilet and eat bland, not very tasty food and handle the heat. But Russia and no problem. So consider that. Okay. All right. I guess we're ready.